Support for The Trend on WNIN comes from members of the Local Programming Fund. I'm Micah Schweitzer. A new study out this week puts a dollar value on Indiana's airports. The Economic Impact Study shows the state's 69 public-use airports create nearly 70,000 jobs and $14 billion in spending. The effort to highlight the state's airports comes as the federal government is spending less on capital improvements for airports. And we're joined now by Bart Giesler. He's the executive director of the Aviation Association of Indiana, which co-sponsored this study. Mr. Giesler, welcome to The Trend. Diana Page is also here in studio, the marketing manager for the Evansville Regional Airport. Nice to have you here as well.
Hello.
And I want to start with you, Bart Giesler. You have different types of airports in the state that you detail in this study, ranging from commercial airports and national airports down to the regional and local levels. Can you give us a sense of what these different types of airports are and how they interrelate?
Yes, thank you for having me on the show. I think everybody probably has a pretty good understanding of a commercial service airport in Evansville. You know, you can go to the airport, or prior to going to the airport, you buy a ticket in advance and you fly to Chicago, Atlanta, Detroit, or Dallas. You know, and the airline have scheduled service, so you know the time that the plane will be departing. But there's also what's called a general aviation airport, and the FAA has broken those general aviation airports into different categories, national, regional, local, and basic. And a lot of times I think those categories are not as well known. You know, what can you do at a general aviation airport? Probably the biggest, differentiation, once again, is, the commercial airlines or the commercial airports, there's about 500 in the United States. Versus 500 general aviation airports. So obviously there's a lot more choices to land at a general aviation facility. You know, so it's, why would somebody use the general aviation? I think it's, the end destinations of having 5,000 destinations. You know, businesses will also use it because of the flexibility. It's, they can leave on their schedule versus, depending on the airline schedule, as well as, the employees are more productive. A lot of times the company may send multiple people out on a flight so they can have pre-meetings on board the plane, as well as post-meetings and recaps of the meetings, on their flight back home, as well as, some time savings with a limited number of flights in or out. Your meeting may get over at 4 o'clock, but the flights, out that day may also occur at 4 o'clock, so there may be an extra evening. So that's some of the services or the, why people might use the general aviation airport versus a commercial service airport. Even though Evansville is a commercial service airport, they also do have the general aviation activity that also takes place at the airport.
So you're giving a sense of the flexibility that's available if you use one of these smaller airports. And looking at the study, I was surprised to see, for instance, the Perry County Airport, which has one employee, according to your study. And you say that generates $9 million. How does such a small airport generate $9 million?
Well, it's, I think, going back to our methodology, there may be one employee at the Perry County Airport, but the Perry County Airport serves more than just, it's more than just the one employee. It's the businesses that utilize the airport are the ones who are actually making up the $9 million in economic output. I'm not sure the local industry there. I believe there may be a steel industry that may be using the airport. And that's how, I'll say, what the purpose of this report was. It was really not, while the airport spending is obviously a contributor to the overall economic impact study, it's the business users who we were really trying to capture with this report. How does the local airport serve the local business community what number of job, and we tried to identify the number of jobs in the community, not necessarily at the airport, but in the community that the airport supports. Whether the businesses use the airport to fly customers in, and fly their salespeople out.
You have some examples of this. You have some examples of this in the report, like the Jasper Engines and Transmissions Exchange using the Huntingburg Airport, or Belt Tech Industrial in Washington using the Daviess County Airport. Just to draw on a couple of examples from this part of the state.
Yes, and it's. You know, I think the Jasper Engines example, pointed out they were able to fly their key staff, to a meeting in Chicago, I believe it was, and back in one day, versus if they would have had to drive to Chicago, they would have had to probably go up the night before, spend the day there, spend the night there, and come back. So in that key instance, it would have been a 3-day. People out of the office, and then you multiply that 3 days times the number of people who'd be out of the office for the day. You can really see the importance, or where aviation is a, as some people refer to it, as a time machine. It's able to allow people to use make the best use of their time.
And I wonder about the reasons for this study. Federal airport funding for capital projects, as I mentioned at the top, is declining. And is this report an effort to maybe remind lawmakers of the role of these airports in the economy of this state?
Yeah, I think it's one of those things. It's, we understand that, our state legislators, our local leaders, when they make investment with tax dollars, they need to make sure that, I'll say it's, times have changed, especially with the property tax caps and just general perception of taxes. What is the return on investment? Why should the legislature invest in airports? Why should the local community invest? I think at the end of the day, it's no different than, community investing in, wastewater treatment, water lines to extend out to a, commercial park, whatever the case may be. That infrastructure, if you don't have it in place, you cannot grow. And the same with airports. It's the airports need proper investment to attract and maintain jobs. At the end, a lot of times when a prospective business, if they fly into a community, the very first thing they see is the airport. And the last thing they see is the airport. So the airports, in many cases, are the first and last impressions as people come in to look to locate a factory or locate their business.
Diana Page, I want to bring you into the conversation. How is the Evansville Airport planning on using this new data?
Well, this just kind of helps us make our argument to the community and to local leaders that we really want to remind people how important the airport is, even if you never plan on flying. I mean, if you're never plan on using the airport, it's still very important to you and your own household bottom line.
And does this affect your marketing efforts? Have you learned anything new from this report that you didn't know before?
Well, we learned a little bit more about the extent. We actually have an actual dollar figure that we can go out and inform the community, and it really strengthens our argument. When we are, looking for new industry to come to town, when we're looking for new service, new airlines, it's very helpful information.
As you take this, Mr. Giesler, as you take this to the Indiana legislature, as you mentioned, how much money are we talking about in terms of state and federal funding for airports?
As you mentioned earlier, the federal government or the FAA, actually in February of this year, when Congress reauthorized the Federal Aviation Administration, airport projects prior to the reauthorization were funded at 95% federal dollars. And 5% was split between the airport and the state. With reauthorization, that number, the FAA's participation has declined down to 90%, meaning 10% needs to be made up at the local and state level. It's actually the FAA's funding participation increased back in 2002 from 90% to 95%. That was
I have to cut you off very briefly here. We'll continue this in just a moment. You're listening to The Trend.
This is The Trend on 88.3 WNIN and WNIN.org. Still ahead, The Hungry Hoosier has a new approach to Thanksgiving sweet potatoes, and we're going to explore what State Superintendent-elect Glenda Ritt's election upset means for education reform. That's trending today on WNIN-FM.
Support for WNIN comes from Morton Solar, a renewable energy solution provider for residential, commercial, governmental, and utility clients. Located in Evansville, Indiana, Morton Solar provides consultation, engineering and design, and installation for projects throughout the tri-state area. Learn more at mortonsolar.com or 812-402-0900.
This is The Trend. I'm Micah Schweitzer. We're discussing the economic role of Indiana's airports with Bart Giesler. He's the executive director of the Aviation Association of Indiana, and Diana Page, the marketing manager at the Evansville Regional Airport. And I want to pick up with where we abruptly left off a minute ago with what Bart Giesler was saying about the change in federal funding for airports, and put that to you, Diana Page. And that is, if the airport and the state combined now have to come up with 10% of funding for capital projects instead of 5% as it used to be, what does that mean for the Evansville Airport?
Well, you know, it means that budgets get a lot tighter. You know, we have to really talk with our legislators about, you know, helping more. We have to look for other sources of revenue. We have to dig in our pockets a little deeper to get projects done. You know, for example, we're working on a $60 million runway project, and that has us, you know, looking at that project very hard. So, you know, it's very significant.
Looking at it very hard, as in you might not be able to do it?
Well, no, we're doing it. It's underway. So, but it affects, you know, what we can do, how much money we have to spend on other projects, because more has to go into that one.
And Bart Giesler, Diana just gave us the example of a runway extension. When we talk about capital projects at airports in general, what are we talking about?
You know, there'd be different types of capital projects, whether it be a runway extension, it may be land acquisition for future, it may be airport landing systems. There's a variety of different projects you know, that are on hold. I think the other important thing to remember is, you know, the FAA will allocate the dollars. However, if an airport is not able to use those dollars, they do not necessarily stay in Indiana. They go back into the federal pot to be redistributed nationwide. So it's important that we make sure that, you know, even though the federal match has decreased down to 90%, it's still a great return for the state and the airport, you know, only funding 10% of the project.
This study was done in 2010, 2011, I believe. Is that right?
2011 and 2012.
2011, 2012. So here we are in this sort of fitful and slow recovery from the Great Recession, as it's been called. Put this in context of the recession. What are some of the challenges, or are airports facing challenges that they weren't, say, 5 years ago, as you went about doing this study?
Well, I think it's as the economy goes, you know, the aviation will go, whether it's on the, you know, people flying to, you know, for commercial purposes or you know, vacation, you know, with less discretionary money, people, you know, less likely to be able to fly on vacation. You know, a lot of the airport's revenues will be dependent upon, you know, more people through the system, whether it be parking or landing fees via the airport. You know, the airlines. So a lot of the airport's funding sources have, you know, as a result of less use because of, you know, the economy slowing down, has tightened, made it more difficult, and especially, as Diane was pointing out, you know, to come up with the extra money for the runway extension in Evansville.
Are these the sorts of things that you're seeing, Diana?
Oh, yes. And we've tried to get very creative, you know, in times like this when the economy is bad and maybe, you know, aviation-related businesses down, we've tried to really diversify our revenue. So we've done things like, leasing space to Berry Plastics, the big warehouse that we have there, building a new subway on site, the new Hampton Inn that's on site. So finding sources of revenue that may not be aviation related, but kind of carry you through those tough times.
Give me a sense of what the Evansville Airport is used for. Bart has talked about commercial and general aviation and the fact that you've got both at the Evansville Airport. So aside from, showing up and hopping on a flight to Chicago or Atlanta or wherever, what other uses other than just passenger travel come into play at the Evansville Airport?
Well, of course, we have passenger travel, like you said, but we do a variety of things through our FBO. I mean, people don't think about the airport, nighttime operations, but sometimes in the middle of the night, we will have an organ donation come through. We have a lot of military that come through to fuel up. We've had the presidential fleet helicopters. We have a Blue Angel here today. We have quite a few, just different, unique things. There's always something going on. But like I said, we've been really trying to open up the airport and show people that there's all kinds of things that we've done. 5K runway or 5K on the runway.
I assume very carefully timed.
No, we used our secondary runway for the race and had our primary, one that was still doing normal operations. So the airport is just an exciting place. There's a lot of different uses. There's cargo. There's just so many things going on.
What are the primary industries that rely on air travel?
Well, of course, Toyota is a main one. There's Alcoa, SABIC, Berry Plastics. You have all the major manufacturing that really drive a lot of that business.
The vendors. That's executives flying around?
That's right. And then we have, a lot of their vendors that come in. And both of the vendors and those corporations use, the commercial and the private side. We also have a lot of small business, people that are going domestic and international. And that's really kind of where the push is. We are a community that most people would be surprised has a lot of international connections. When we're going out and talking to airlines and trying to get more flights, that's one of the biggest things that we try to promote, because that's where all the growth in the industry is going to come from, is in international versus domestic. So when we can show both on small businesses and large businesses, where they're going and why, that really gets the attention of those airlines, because that they know that that's where the growth is going to come from.
Why international and not domestic?
Well, domestic, pretty much all the routes, are formulated. There's not a whole lot of growth potential because, there's service to most places in the United States. A lot of the emerging markets, the international business that's being done in South America, over in Europe, in Canada, that's where the domestic, the Uniteds, the Deltas, that's where they're seeing growth. So if they, Evansville is not a candidate for international direct flights. However, we might get more flights to, a connection point that serves those. So we would have more domestic service that we could use, but they get the benefit of getting those international travelers.
Sort of the, not to talk about boats, but the rising tide that lifts all boats.
Exactly.
So Atlanta flies more international flights, and you get a bump from that too.
That's right.
I see. In terms of, Bart Giesler, in terms of what comes next, what do you do with this study now?
Well, I think, this is the first step of articulating the impact. Obviously, the legislative session will be here in January. We'll be talking to our state legislators. Earlier you asked, how much, the state, does put into aviation. When the state's match was contributing 2.5%, that state share was about $1.2 million. So even at the 5% match, that doubles to approximately, let's say, $2.5 million. It's still a great investment for the state, as supporting 69,000 jobs in Indiana, and that's probably a conservative number. If we did not receive surveys back, we did not try to capture those numbers. So, in some cases, if you look at the economic impacts study, some airports did not show any tenants or users. That does not mean that there are no users. That just means that, you know, the users were uncomfortable with the survey process, not knowing, with this being the first time that we've done the survey of this way. You know, they didn't know how it would be done. They didn't want to be out there. So it's, you know, hopefully, you know, down the road, and next time we do the survey, more businesses will be willing to fill out the survey.
How quickly do you think this kind of a snapshot of the aviation situation in Indiana changes? I mean, how soon would you need to do another study to get the most current information?
It's whenever we did the study, we actually modeled it after the North Carolina airports. They did a similar study, and they actually did their study the second time was this year, so it was a 5-year wait in between. So that's, you know, at this point in time, you know, what we are planning. Hopefully, you know, if the, you know, the economy, you know, rebounds and we feel there's a need to, you know, that, like I said, we did not capture as many, you know, corporations from the survey, we may do it, but it was, I'll say, a difficult process. You know, nobody likes filling out surveys, especially not knowing how everything would be used. You know, so like I said, I think it should last. You know, it is a snapshot in time, but we think that snapshot, you know, should be good for about 5 years or so.
And last question to you, just briefly. We have about 30 seconds left. Diana Page, what are the biggest challenges right now that you're looking to overcome with at the Evansville Airport?
Well, I think the challenges are just the changes in the market. You know, a lot of the carriers with the economy have downsized. There's fewer seats and fewer numbers of flights available for our passengers. So it's really important to us to emphasize, you know, how important the airport is to the community and the community's health. So that's going to be what we use this study for, to really you know, make that argument. It's kind of like having I-69 built in your community but not having any on or off ramps. I mean, if we lost all of our service, you lose your access to that air transportation highway.
Any risk of losing service?
No, I mean, like I said, it's sort of this business, you know, you lose flights here and then you gain some more flights. I think Evansville is pretty comfortable that we will always have service, but of course we want to have the best service possible for our local passengers, for their convenience, but also just for our own economic development efforts in this community.
That's Diana Page. She's the marketing manager at the Evansville Regional Airport. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And on the phone, we've been talking with Bart Giesler, executive director of the Aviation Association of Indiana. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Trend, and associate producer Tony Voss joins us now for our mid-show B segment.
This week, Micah, essayist Ted Hutchison is back with another edition of The Hungry Hoosier, and he's got a new twist on a classic Thanksgiving staple, the sweet potato.
Healthy eating is usually the last thing on our minds at Thanksgiving, but hidden in our starch, sugar, and fat-laden menus are some foods that pack a nutritional wallop. One of those is the humble sweet potato, full of complex carbs, fiber, and a whole alphabet full of vitamins. Back in the 1920s, the per capita sweet potato consumption was 29 pounds a year. Today, each of us only consumes about 4 pounds annually, and I think much of that is in the months of November and December. There are some among us for whom a Thanksgiving without marshmallow-topped sweet potatoes is no Thanksgiving at all. It will probably come as a big shock to hear that not a single marshmallow would have been found at that first Thanksgiving feast in 1621. But not only that, there probably weren't even sweet potatoes on the table. So how did this Turkey Day accompaniment become so ubiquitous? It seems that this sweet-as-candy version of the popular Thanksgiving side dish is actually a little less than a century old. The first known reference is from a 1917 edition of the local newspaper in Lowell, Massachusetts. This was about the time, you remember, when Americans were eating lots of them. So food historian Janet Clarkson unearthed this recipe from the newspaper's pages. Slice boiled sweet potatoes and place them in a buttered baking dish with layers of brown sugar, dotted with butter between the layers of potatoes. Cover the top with 2 tablespoons of cream, dots of butter, and bake until brown. A few minutes before serving, cover the top with a layer of marshmallows and return to the oven to brown. Now, growing up, my family sweet potatoes were not too much of a departure from this 1917 version. Sometimes the spuds would be mashed, sometimes in chunks, sometimes they would come out of a can or from the produce aisle. Pecans would be added occasionally, but marshmallows were an ever-present feature. But sometime during adulthood, when I could design my own Thanksgiving menu, I decided I wanted to save dessert for, well, dessert, and began seeking out more savory ways to prepare sweet potatoes. About 3 years ago, our family settled on sweet potatoes au gratin. Now, au gratin is a dish most of us have had using white potatoes. But as it turns out, it's just as delicious with sweet potatoes. The natural sugar of these orange tubers make this dish just sweet enough without sending you into an insulin coma. So to make the dish, you peel and slice about 2 pounds of sweet potatoes and layer them in a baking dish along with grated Gruyere cheese. Now, a bit of heavy cream gets poured onto the top, and then some fresh rosemary, salt, and pepper added as well. The dish bakes for about an hour and a half in a 300-degree oven. Now, of course, you can get the full recipe on the website. So, unless, you know, Uncle Max is going to write you out of his will for not bringing to the table those candied yams, consider giving this version a whirl. So go ahead, 86 of those marshmallows. You might just find a new family favorite.
Song, song of the South, sweet potato pie and I shut my mouth. Gone, gone with the wind, there ain't nobody looking back again.
Well, the first time the Trend's ever taken a little trip to Alabama as part of the B segment. Scott Hutchison works in economic and community development for Purdue University and writes about food, family, and community for newspapers, magazines, radio, and TV. The Hungry Hoosier is a production of WBAA in West Lafayette, and at the Trends Facebook page, you'll find Scott's recipe for sweet potatoes au gratin. Dig in, Micah.
Thank you, Tony. You're listening to The Trend. I'm Micah Schweitzer. Under the leadership of State Superintendent of Public Instruction Tony Bennett, Indiana was a national model for school reform, but much of that reform was seen as heavy-handed by teachers. Backed by fellow educators and a grassroots campaign, Glenda Ritz won an unexpected victory over Bennett in the recent election, raising questions about where Indiana's education policies are now headed. We're joined now by Kyle Stokes. He's an education reporter for State Impact Indiana based at WFIU in Bloomington. And Kyle, you were one of the very first guests we ever had on this show, so welcome back.
It's good to be back, Micah.
And let's start with this chronologically. Why did Tony Bennett, the state superintendent of public instruction, not win re-election?
There are a bunch of different answers to this question. I think the biggest element here is that Tony Bennett lost teachers early on and never got them back. I think that that's probably one of the largest takeaways in the kind of postmortem of this election is that we've seen that teacher support for the candidate for superintendent of public instruction really matters. And what you heard from a lot of people at the very cellular level of this campaign were people going out, teachers, concerned parents, telling people, not political people, that were saying, I don't tell you how to vote in any election, but here I am telling you that the changes to education policy are affecting my job. I don't like them, and we need to vote this guy out of office. Those kinds of concerns were the primary drivers in this campaign. It was a stunningly effective grassroots effort that mobilized through social media and through face-to-face contacts, you know, obviously, as you can see from the results of the election, a really broad coalition to unseat a man who I think a lot of people thought was a very tough incumbent in Tony Bennett. And there are a lot of kind of, if you want to even zoom in even further, there are a lot of other ingredients there, too. We saw Tony Bennett lose a lot of his Republican support, and that's because I think that what supporters are telling me, they made a lot of arguments that were really successful in terms of saying what Bennett is doing takes away control from local schools. And even at the most extreme levels, you have national education standards known as the Common Core that Bennett was pushing for implementation and actually implementing right now in Indiana schools in certain grade levels. And what those are essentially are national standards that are, you know, kind of in everything but name, federal, nationalized education standards for what children are taught in school. And that didn't really sit well with conservatives. So when you kind of pull back out what that looks like is a lot of support from teachers, and in addition to some key votes from, if you want to say that they're Tea Party types, in the political polls, they'll show up as very conservative voters who really kind of defected from the Bennett camp and saw that in the results on Election Day.
And one of the oddities in all of this is an article that I read that said that now President Obama's education initiatives have potentially suffered a setback because a Democrat was elected superintendent of public instruction here in Indiana because of those core standards that you were just talking about a minute ago.
Exactly. And I think it really talks to how Tony Bennett was in kind of an awkward position because of the way that education politics don't necessarily line up with the broader politics of our nation right now. You have Republicans like Tony Bennett who push really hard for really kind of big government solutions, if you want to kind of characterize them that way, because the way that you implement an accountability system is that you have more government oversight, more government control of what's going on in a school. And like I sort of just mentioned with the Common Core, I mean, a lot of these concerns compounded upon themselves and really hurt his case with conservatives. And I think that you would have just as many Democrats as Republicans. You talk about groups like Democrats for Education Reform that probably stood with Bennett more than they did with Ritz on a lot of issues. But yeah, that's absolutely right. The politics of education right now are really tricky.
And so that leads me to ask you, because there seem to be two different narratives here as well, how much power does the superintendent of public instruction actually have? If we look at Tony Bennett's tenure, it would seem like quite a lot, given the sweeping reforms he was able to institute in 4 years. But there are questions of how much power Glenda Ritz is going to have in the same role.
Absolutely. And the question, I think you can boil the question down to, I think the best way to frame that question is to decide what level of policy you're looking at. There are policies that are set in statute, that are set in the General Assembly, in state law, by state lawmakers, and those are the level of policies where I think Glenda Ritz's clout could be fairly minimal. She's not going to have the votes to come in and change the massive overhaul to education policy that we saw in the state, particularly in the 2011 session where we had rules for teacher collective bargaining go through, new rules for charter schools, the statewide voucher program passed that year. Those are things that are probably not likely to be undone in the legislature. Glenda Ritz doesn't have the votes to do that. What you hear, though, is that at the state board level, at the executive level, in the kind of bureaucratic workings, this is where Glenda Ritz has a lot of potential to make some huge changes to what's going on. And I guess huge depends on your perspective on how big the changes would be on the inside. But for example, there are school choice advocates that are telling me they're concerned that a person who is not in favor of school choice in relation to charter schools or private schools, that someone who is of that persuasion now has control over the finer details of those programs. And they cite examples of how at the cellular level you can really disrupt the good workings of a voucher program or of charter schools because you just have organizational control. Now, at the same time, we have to mitigate that by looking at the composition of the executive panel that oversees the Department of Education, which is appointed by the governor. The State Board of Education is appointed by the governor. It has to have six. It can have no more than six members of one political party on that board. So it isn't necessarily a completely partisan board, but it's not hard to find Democrats who would not like taking away a lot of the power that is being invested in school choice programs and charter schools and in private schools and things like this, that the state board could be appointed in a way that it's very hostile to Ritz. And I think that this is where we sort of get into the area of rank speculation, because we don't know what happens until they're sitting across the table from each other.
But her supporters seem to be concerned that there could be some hostility given the recent email campaign that's been going on, more grassroots efforts even after the election to say, look, our votes for Glenda Ritz count and mean something. And you can't just say because you have a Republican supermajority in the House and Senate and the Republican governorship that you can ignore what she brings to the table.
Exactly. And this gets into that question of mandate and those kind of tricky political questions. I think the only thing you can really say from standing in the middle of that is that the electorate did send, in the education lens, something of a mixed message. They did elect a governor who is very much in favor of school choice policies, who said that there is no problem that ails Indiana education that can't be solved by giving parents more school choice. And I think that you kind of weigh that against the message that they sent with electing Glenda Ritz. You have to understand, though, that I think that what they're fearing is that Glenda Ritz will be completely and totally shut out. And I don't think that, from what we've seen by some of the statements that have been recently reported on from key leaders here in the General Assembly, like, for example, Senator Dennis Cruz yesterday, according to one report that I saw, said at a panel that he was kind of backpedaling on his support for the Common Core, which we mentioned earlier here. It's one of Bennett's signature initiatives. And that's something that Glenda Ritz has also advocated for a second look at Common Core state standards. So on this and some other issues, I'm not sure that it's clear yet that Glenda Ritz will be shut out of the conversation. And I think that it's just one of those things that we're just going to have to watch as we go forward. I had one expert tell me it's kind of a parlor game to try and guess how personalities are going to clash when you before they necessarily are sitting in the chairs facing each other. And the truth of the matter is we don't know. And I don't know necessarily, given we don't know the makeup of the state board, and we don't know necessarily exactly what all of the new members of General Assembly feel on these issues, that she necessarily is going to come in and be the lame duck that I think a lot of her grassroots supporters are really fearing she's going to be.
We're talking with education reporter Kyle Stokes, and we'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Trend.
I'm Tony Voss, and you're with The Trend here on WNIN.org and WNIN-FM. Support for the program today comes through a grant from the Charles and Jan Stimftonoggle family, who encourage your support of public broadcasting, and also through a grant from Trailer Brothers Incorporated, who invites you to join them in support of public radio.
I'm Micah Schweitzer. This is The Trend. We're talking with State Impact Indiana education reporter Kyle Stokes. What are you watching for next in all of this?
Well, I think that what you're not watching for is a lot easier to say. I think we're not watching for big changes to the state's voucher program or charter schools or teacher collective bargaining. I don't think that she has the votes in the Indiana General Assembly to make changes on this. What I'm looking for really now are some of the changes on the cellular level. The key for education policy going forward, I think you can say this much with some assurity, is really going to be at the state board level. And we've already seen the tremendous amount of influence that an activist state board can have. When you look at the iRead 3 policy, the new third grade reading exam, that was something that was not necessarily written into statute, that even some lawmakers in the General Assembly said the state board, we never told the state board to create this test or move forward on this test, and it made some of state lawmakers uncomfortable. The state board has a lot of influence, and how Glenda Ritz interacts with that board is going to be key. If she, depending on what kind of position she stakes out, it could be possible that she can move forward on some of her interests, which probably align more in the area of testing and trying to figure out how to, I mean, she's very concerned about the levels at which students are being tested, the amount of testing they're receiving, and the kinds of testing they receive. They want to implement a new statewide test that would essentially replace the ISTEP. Now, I'm not sure whether that's going to happen, but a lot of the critical conversations on that are going to happen at the state board level. And there might be room for compromise, and there might be ground at which they can both strike and they can both figure out a way to work with each other. The kind of worst-case scenario for a RITS supporter is that the state board is openly hostile to RITS, does shut her out, but it's hard to say that that's necessarily what we're looking at this point. I'm not really sure that she's coming in there to push on a locked door. I think that there is some openings and there might be some opportunity for common ground, but whatever is going to happen, the success of Glenda Ritz's agenda at this point, until the Democrats sweep in and retake the General Assembly, if that happens, or she finds the votes to make changes to state law, the key is going to be in the state board.
I want to ask you about another specific policy. You mentioned the iRead 3 exam. Here's a policy that we recently saw in the news, in the headlines, and that is the new A through F grading system for schools, which grades how well schools are doing. Talk a little bit about how this was implemented and designed and the reasons for it.
Absolutely. You have to go back to the requirements of the No Child Left Behind law under the law that was signed in 2001, so famously known as No Child Left Behind. And that was a law that a lot of people eventually over the years have come to see as misguided. That's a pretty broad consensus that the law's effects were that the law's implementation was something that was hurting schools and not necessarily making them better, that things were being muddled on implementation. So the federal government opened it up and said, we want your solutions. If you've got a better way to make sure that we're keeping schools accountable for their test scores, we're open to hear it. And Indiana's A to F letter grading system, as it's now come to be known, started as a state law, a state-implemented system that actually predates No Child Left Behind, but it was modified to become basically a replacement. It's part of a waiver for No Child Left Behind. So that's how it sort of came to be. And in implementation, what state education officials really hoped to do was try and find a way to track whether students were making a year's worth of growth. And instead of doing the system that we had before, which only looked at the average number of students, the rate at which students in a school were passing and failing statewide tests, they wanted to change that system because when you're only looking at a kind of a boilerplate number, at an average, at a rate at which students are passing and failing tests, you don't really understand what's going on at the kid level. And the new system is designed to, at least the intention is, try and measure this to a little bit closer degree of accuracy, how well students individually are doing on statewide tests. That is the intention. It has been widely criticized that it doesn't necessarily do this. It comes close, but does not necessarily measure students' individual growth. And by the way, this might be one of the areas in which Glenda Ritz could possibly make some headway in rewiring this system, depending on what way she wants to rewire the system, because there are reports that the General Assembly's education leadership has said, we're okay with rewiring this, because there was a lot of concern about this. But I think that what with the new A to F grades, what we saw come out was something that I think was a tricky process of implementation. It was really hard to put all of this data together. It was a complex process. A lot of districts had trouble reconciling the data they had with the grades they were getting. We saw huge delays in this. But after all of the hoopla, after a lot of concerns coming out in the press, most schools got A's and B's, and most schools' grades also didn't change all that much. So I think that after all of this is over, we saw that there was a lot of smoke, but not necessarily a lot of fire, if you will. I think that people feared, and early estimates, in fact, showed a lot of schools would get a really bad letter grade under this new system. And what I think we saw was that, you know, schools didn't do that all that bad.
And that was certainly borne out here in southwestern Indiana, where you saw mostly A's, B's, and C's. But the Evansville-Vandenberg School Corporation got 10% of all the F's in the state. So any reason that you can point to that there would be a concentration like that?
You know, I think that this is one of the greatest concerns about the A to F letter grades in general, is that when you talk about PBSC, you're talking about the, and you know, bigger urban districts in general. You're talking about generally schools that have higher reduced price lunch populations, lower socioeconomics, generally associated with lower test scores, and people are going to continue to, I mean, this is a concern we heard under the old system, under the new system. Poverty is one of the driving factors of schools getting lower grades. And so I think that that's just one of those things that if the system is set up right, if the system is set up to truly track students from point A to point B, that you're able to, from point A to B, point B meaning last year's test score to this year's test score, when you're able to measure that, you can kind of cancel out the socioeconomic factors. So the problem could be in the model. On the other hand, what the model did was compare students from all across the state who got the same score and set a growth target for them to make in the next year, basically, and if they made that target, it would not hurt their school's letter grade. And if they shot above the target, then that helps out their school's letter grade. But if they're not hitting that target, that can hurt a school's letter grade. So, you know, the problem on one hand, like I say, could be in the model, but on the other hand, it could be on the school. And that's a possibility that is opened up here, too. There is, that's why they call it accountability. This is one possibility that has to be considered as well, that perhaps the school, the students themselves, that the school wasn't moving students to games at the levels that are required under the model, because the model also takes into account that if you have a student who's not performing very well in the year before, and the evidence suggests that in most socioeconomic schools that you have a lot of students who are probably going to come in behind for various numbers of reasons, if you're not making not just a year's worth of growth, but more than a year's worth of growth, then you're not doing what's right for that kid. And that's probably one of the arguments that you could hear, too, is that we need them to be making more than a year's worth of growth. Now, I can't speak to the individual situation. I know Glenwood Leadership Academy was the one that you can think about in Evansville that has received a couple of Fs in a row. But that speaks, again, to bigger problems here in terms of poverty. And it's one of the concerns overall that an A to F grading model shaped like this is always going to leave high poverty schools on the short end.
Well, certainly a lot of things to be watching for in this next year with Glenda Ritz taking over as superintendent of public instruction here in Indiana. And I know it'll be a busy 2013 for you watching the Indiana legislative session. Kyle Stokes, thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, never a dull moment, Micah. Thank you.
Kyle Stokes is an education reporter for State Impact Indiana based at WFIU in Bloomington. You're listening to The Trend.
I'm Tony Voss, and this is The Trend on 88.3 WNIN and WNIN.org. Support for the program today comes from Evansville Day School, preparing for college, preparing for life for over 60 years. Information online at evansvilledayschool.org.
This is The Trend. I'm Micah Schweitzer, and it's time now for the Arts Notebook. Courier and press writer Sean McDevitt is once again in the studio filling in for Roger McBain. Hey, Sean.
Micah, great to be back with you.
And Sean, it seems like an Americana string band on the Victory Theater stage is just a great combination, and ticket sales certainly are bearing that out. You had a chance to talk with a member of Old Crow Medicine Show recently.
I did, actually, Micah. I talked to Christopher Critter Fuqua, and I've encountered a lot of interesting musician nicknames over the years, but Critter is probably at or near the top of them. But these guys, you know, just when you think there's nothing new under the sun and in music, these guys have really found a way to kind of hit the reset button, you know, with their combination of old-time American roots music and sort of put on top of a rock foundation. Critter told me the band really goes back to his junior high days in Virginia, and his musical partner is a guy named Jay Secor. Everyone just calls him Ketch, though. But when they were growing up in the 80s, they liked these hard-rocking bands like Guns N' Roses, and later they got into grunge bands like Nirvana. But by the time they had gotten into high school, they were really into American roots music, and Critter told me that he had a love for country blues, and Ketch was interested in Appalachian string bands. So by the time all these kind of stylistic preferences merged, you know, they had created something that was all their own. I think this is going to be a pretty good show at the Victory on Sunday.
Now, over at the Center this weekend, there's a large art show coming to Evansville.
Yeah, Micah, this is called the Evansville Fine Art Show. It's a large juried show that's going to be at the Center Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. It looks like there's going to be about 50 artists, and many of them are going to be from the Midwest and beyond. Drawing, painting, photography, mixed media, sculpture, glass, items, you know, ranging from $25 and up. So I think there's going to be an awful lot there, something for everybody.
And they're hoping this becomes maybe an annual tradition. Let's talk now about an event that is an established yearly tradition, and that is the Hottie Shrine Circus.
Absolutely. Thanksgiving is when this all kicks off. This is the 79th. Annual Hottie Shrine Circus. As everyone knows, it was at Roberts Stadium for decades. This is the second year that it's going to be at the Ford Center. And apparently the transition to there has been pretty smooth so far.
And what about the animal acts?
Well, I talked to Joe Vizoso, who's the executive director of the circus, and it was really interesting. He told me that, you know, the circus goers will be able to enjoy, you know, a lot of the traditional animal acts. Things like tigers and elephants will be present. But he said that, you know, as the years have gone by, it's increasingly difficult to get these acts. He mentioned orangutans and gray seals, you know, are examples of two, we'll call them former circus performers, that are no longer around. And this is really because, you know, some of these acts are taken off the road. The animals go into retirement, or in some cases they're even federal regulations, you know, that stop it. So he said to get out and enjoy these while you can. You shouldn't assume that forever and ever and ever you're just going to be able to go to the circus and see elephants or tigers or lions or anything else.
But you can always see clowns.
You can always see clowns. This is a really time-honored component of the circus. The Hottie Shrine Funsters. These folks have really been a staple of the event. And you really have to give them credit. You know, they're all of them are really giving up their entire Thanksgiving weekend, along with lots and lots of other volunteers to make this event happen.
Sean McDevitt writes for the Evansville Courier and Press. His articles are in Thursday's and Sunday's paper, and of course online at courierpress.com. Sean, thanks so much for filling in these past 2 weeks.
My pleasure, Micah. Thanks for having me.
Next week, we'll listen back to some conversations from earlier this year, including our interview with Courier and Press political cartoonist James McLeod and singer-songwriter Jonathan Colton. To get in touch with The Trend, click on The Trend at WNIN.org, and you'll find links there for getting in touch on Facebook, Twitter, and by email. Weekly podcasts are at our website and at CourierPress.com. We're also on iTunes. The Trend is a production of WNIN in collaboration with the Evansville Courier and Press. Ryan Reynolds is our producer there. Tony Voss is our associate producer and engineer. Our theme music was written by Jeffrey Osman. I'm Micah Schweitzer. We'll talk next week. This is WNIN-FM, Evansville, Henderson, and Owensboro.